door, slam shut, and it's on.
That's pretty darn creepy.
Listen, this is gonna sound totally crazy, and I know that, but I'm having this feeling lately that maybe whatever happened to us when we were little, I think it's starting again.
I don't want to talk about this, Christy.
I just remember being scared all the time.
Whatever it was, it thrived on fear. The more we paid attention to it, the worse it got. You need to leave this alone.
Welcome to Now Playing's Paranormal Activity Retrospective Series.
You promised me you weren't going to mess with that stuff.
You cannot run from this. It will follow you.
Hosted by Arnie.
They just about think he's the coolest guy ever.
Jacob.
I know that elders like Jacob can feel kind of intense, but as long as you stick with me, you'll be fine.
And Stuart.
There are these malevolent evil spirits that only exist to cause pain and commit evil for their own amusement.
This podcast will contain harsh language, movie spoilers, and may try to scare you with loud, sudden banging.
And you're not in control. It is in control. And if you think you're in control, then you're being an idiot.
Listener discretion is advised.
You know, we can't just let this affect us that much. If we do that, the terrorists win.
Today we're discussing Paranormal Activity 2, starring Sprague Graydon, Ryan Boland, Molly Ephraim, Katie Featherston, directed by Todd Williams. This is the Now Playing co-host full of podcasting activity 2, Arnie.
And Stuart.
And this is Krabby McRumpelstein, a.k.a. Jacob.
Well, we didn't have to wait long. I didn't go see it at all, but if you were excited about Paranormal Activity, and some of us on this call were...
No.
Then you could get not one, but two sequels within a year's time. Did you guys know this? Which one did you watch? I should just put it out there. There's one in Tokyo, and then there's one in Carlsbad.
I watched the Carlsbad one.
Oh, good.
But it also said unrated, so it was like an extra cut.
Yeah, I saw the unrated one, but I do love that there's Paranormal Activity Tokyo Nights. It's kind of like Baywatch Nights for ghosts.
Were you guys able to find this? I looked. I saw a trailer on YouTube, and it was mostly the audience reacting to something.
Yeah, you know what? We had a real debate about whether this should be its own show. If they're both called Paranormal Activity 2, where does it rank? I guess within days, if you were in Tokyo in October 2010... you could literally walk into one theater and see Paranormal Activity 2, or you could walk into another one and see Paranormal Activity 2 Tokyo Night. It was the same time these things were out. But it is connected. I will just go ahead and say that it reminded me of kind of when we covered the Grudge series. And remember how, like, the curse migrated from the Ju-on movies, and then it became the Grudge movies, and they kept all the old Japanese movies within realm.
Did someone from Japan, like, walk through the house in the last movie and bring it over there?
Even better.
They save it for the end, because you don't know there's a connection until the very end. But you find out after killing Mika, Katie walked out in the street and just walked into an intersection, was hit by a car, and the demon jumped onto the girl who was driving the car that killed Katie.
Yeah. What you were to understand is that Katie, yes, gets killed, and her demon leaps bodies, kind of like the Grudge does, and hopped in on this. She was an exchange student. She was going to school in San Diego, but she, now that she has two broken legs, goes back to her house to live with her brother and her dad in Tokyo, and a lot of the similar stuff. I mean, it does feel like the same kind of Paranormal Activity.
Oh, no, because my big question was, do the Japanese do it any better, or is it just footsteps the whole time? Are there any visuals? Do you see anything scary?
At one point in the credits, it talks about it's a remake of the first movie, and I dare say that
the scares and the escalation is a remake of the first movie, but I do love that at the end, when she gets possessed, the Japanese girl does look like she's coming right out of your television in The Ring or something. She gets that stringy hair in her face and everything. I mean, you gotta think this fits in the Japanese ghost girl genre film very well.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think could start with Poltergeist and then see The Ring as a copy of that. And now we have the found footage ripoff of Poltergeist that gets taken back to the place that made The Ring. And so there's a lot of overlap for sure. I think one technical improvement that I have not seen in the movie we're here to talk about this week or the one last week, simple, but I think effective, they put video side by side.
Yes.
So people would sleep in different rooms and you would actually be able to compare what was going on in one room with another room. That showed skill.
That was really nice. It was the nicest thing about the movie. I actually, though, really disliked the Japanese movie because, first of all, I didn't care about the brother and sister couple the way that I cared about the boyfriend and girlfriend in the first movie.
You really care about Katie and Mika.
But I enjoyed their interplay. There's like an hour before getting scared, and I enjoyed their interplay during it better than the brother and sister. And also, I believed in Paranormal Activity 1, why they kept those cameras going as much as they did. But in this Tokyo movie, the rationale for why they keep recording a lot of these scenes is thin to non-existent. You just have to understand that they're going to film each other eating breakfast even if they don't expect cool things to happen.
Oh, so it's like the movie we're going to discuss tonight.
It is the original movie. They do funny little tweaks, and I'll go ahead and spoil this much. They even do the thing with the Mika character being thrown at the camera at the end, but it doesn't stop there. He actually lives through that and continues on and has a couple more scenes, and they give you a different kind of ending, which I appreciated. And a twist on a character that you hadn't been thinking about also being killed.
Yeah, I gotta say, though, not recommend for Tokyo Night. I liked the split screen, and I liked that at the end it had an unexpected tie into the original movie where it still, even with the movie we're going to talk about tonight, Tokyo Night could be in continuity. But overall, I was just bored to crap watching Tokyo Night. And also, it may hurt that I have to read subtitles and I can't just stare into the darkness to look for ghosts.
I would say that they're comparable. I would say that, again, it reminded me of a Ju-on movie, a Grudge movie. If you like that, or if you like the movie last week, you should probably give it a try, but I don't feel terrible that we're not reviewing it as its own standalone. And you're right, Arnie. What we're here to talk about is a prequel. We can't know what happens after Katie disappeared because, well, this is all the filler. This is the stuff that's going to tell you some of the backstory I was asking for last time. This movie was big. This thing, like, they rushed it out. First movie comes out in March on DVD, 2010. They shoot for 3 weeks in May, and October, it is released. And here's the punchline, in IMAX.
What?
Yeah, they blew up this image really big, charged IMAX prices, and this thing opened at $40 million. It was number one, huge.
I remember that. I remember it being huge. I didn't remember the IMAX bit. I remember, though, not really caring all that much because of the found footage-ness. It was a entire phenomena that escaped my notice. I do have to ask, though, do you know if this was shot on a video camera like the last one? Because I noticed at the end a credit for a company called Photochem, filmed, not videoed.
No, I believe it's all digital. They've increased the budget. This thing costs $3 million as opposed to $15,000. But I think that, you know, there's more cameras here. We have different setups. It's a much more sophisticated film.
That is my question, yeah. Do they set up some kind of real semi-professional digital camera, or are they actually using security footage? Because those things barely do, like, 720 DPI. Like, it would look horrible.
Yeah, I remember teaching people to install security systems back then, and the cameras you got were a frame every few seconds, and yeah, you had to have running videotapes. There wasn't the Wi-Fi connections you have now. Ring cameras revolutionized the security camera industry, and what they had back when this movie is taking place, not when this movie came out, but this movie takes place in 2006. This is an expensive, high-end system they have.
I think if it went to IMAX, you would have to get a professional-grade digital. And they solved the beef with Saw. You complained last week that Saw 6 came out against Paranormal Activity and lost. That was kind of amazing. They respectfully opened the week earlier and Saw, the 3D Saw movie, came out the next week and it could be number one. So, and ironically, the director of that movie was supposed to make this movie. Paranormal Activity 2, they were getting the Saw 6 guy, but I guess Lionsgate had him under contract and said, no, you're making Jigsaw. You're not jumping ship.
It's funny that this film's history, the franchise's history, is intertwined with Saw, because like I'm watching this one, I'm like, oh, we're doing Saw level like retconning and storytelling here. Like, not expecting this.
And yet at the same time, it's anti-Saw, right? Because if Saw is torture porn, we're going to show you as graphically as possible. The aesthetics of this movie is inference. Everything is in the dark.
Yeah, if Saw's torture porn, this is the Sears bra ad.
And so it should, again, I mentioned that they were going for different directors. It should be noted, Oren Peli did not want to come back. He comes back as a producer, but he wanted to make something else, which I get, right?
Yeah, because he's still going to get paid for these.
And there's only one place to go but down, right? Steven Spielberg didn't make Jaws 2. William Friedkin didn't do Exorcist 2. Too bad. But, you know, usually you just hand that off to somebody else because you know it will be disappointing. And you take that goodwill and you make something that is a little bit different. And unfortunately, it sounded like a good idea. He wanted to do found footage again, but this time it was kids breaking into Area 51, and it would all be about aliens, and instead of paranormal activity, it would be UFOs chasing people around Nevada. I don't know if you've seen this movie, but
this got made?
Yes, it's made. He made that film, and it sat on a shelf for 6 years before it got dumped to, like, maybe two theaters and straight to home viewing. I did dig up a copy, and really the problem is, it still looks like they're filming in someone's bedroom, but like they're claiming that this is a government institution. Like, this is Area 51, but it looks like your garage. I'm like, no. A decent surprise at the end. I will say that maybe the last 5 minutes is worth your time, but by and large, just hokey. And there's a reason I think Oren Peli is not a director that has gone on to, you know, he's a producer. He also produced Insidious, which I feel like is Paranormal Activity made as a straight horror movie.
That's much more what I would have expected, though, from Paranormal Activity 2. I felt like, especially with the ending of the first film, we're in for an anthology. I figured every movie we're going to have different people, different families, different ghosts all on videotape. Kind of like, you know, you mentioned the VHS series and things. So I just thought this was an anthology series of ghost stories. I was shocked that this one is a prequel that ties in directly to part one.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm shocked that they're having these non-actor actors return. My prediction was, we'll tell the real story in the next one. Now that this thing is a surprise hit, like, we'll figure it out. But nope, they're all coming back.
Well, again, they're all coming back but Oren Peli. They did have to find new creative forces.
And the psychic, unfortunately.
Yeah, he's gone. Too bad. But yeah, they had to get screenwriters. Like, I just want to point out, we have people that are actually paid to write other things are now working on this concept. Although I wonder.
Yeah, there's a script this time, really?
There is. No, there for sure there is. There's three screenwriters on this, which leads me to believe that they just basically probably asked people for concepts. What would be really spooky? And then they just shot a bunch of stuff. You know, like I said, in 3 weeks' time, it doesn't all cut together. There are two different cuts of this movie. There's the extended cut and the theatrical cut. And then there's extra scenes on the DVD that don't make sense because the characters are doing things that they don't do in the movie. They're different people almost. So I feel like they probably shot it all different kinds of ways. And they weren't so much worried about character arcs as what was the best jump scare. The best jump scare was going to be the thing that winds up in the movie.
There is one character in this movie that does take a strange turn that I couldn't follow, and we will talk about it. But I feel like the way this is played, that like the last one, these people weren't given a script with dialogue to memorize and recite, that they were given a concept of, hey, in this scene, here's your conversation. Ad lib.
There were scripts. They were given scenes. I believe what they were given pages, but maybe not a full complete script. But yes, there are, again, if there are WGA members on this, then things were written down and done. And that's why they got paid. That's why they're on here. And it's worth pointing out, Christopher Landon, one of those three people, will go on to write many of the sequels. So maybe the continuity that they're shoehorning in here will be expanded upon as we get to 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. His name is on most of them. But just worth pointing out, the director of this film, they went through a lot of them. They asked a bunch of people, including the Saw 6 guy. The craziest one was Brian De Palma, was actually on the block.
Wait, what?
He was doing found footage at this time. He had done something about Army Vets that was really done low-res video.
They weren't going to hit a $3 million budget with De Palma.
I don't know why they didn't go with De Palma, but yes, they decided they didn't need to do that. Also, if you've seen the Wolf Creek guy, the Australian psychological thriller movies, Greg McLean is the maker of those. Akiva Goldsman, Oscar-winning writer of Beautiful Mind, and Razzie winner of writing Batman and Robin, not one of my favorite screenwriters. All these people were approached, but in the end, they went with a real oddball choice. And the only thing I can think of is maybe one, he was available. He could shoot within the 3 weeks that they needed to get this thing done. And two, maybe they wanted to work on the family relationships. They went with Todd Williams, who up to this point had only made quirky family dramas and comedies. Adventures of Sebastian Cole. I don't know if you...
Nope.
No.
Yeah. It kind of came and went. It kind of feels a little bit like a Wes Anderson thing. Quirky family drama. And then Door in the Floor is an adaptation of John Irving's A Widow for 1 Year. Had Jeff Bridges and Kim Basinger and was supposed to be real Oscar bait. And I guess because it wasn't, it flopped.
Yeah, never heard of it.
Yeah, he ended up doing this instead. But again, that signals to me, if they're not going with a horror guy or a guy that's known for punking you, then they really want us to care about Katie and Mika, and in this case, Katie's sister and her family as well. We're going to work on those relationships.
This is the folly of a college education. There's no way they planned on any of that. They are not signaling this is going to be a family-oriented movie. I cannot go there. This is all about budget. Who can we afford for $3 million?
Well, maybe, but I mean, they hired real actors. I just want to point out that Christy Ray is not played by Christy Ray.
Yeah, I feel like you're going into Arnie territory. Tell me the real stuff she's done.
Yeah, exactly. Real actors.
She was on 6 Feet Under. She was on a season of 24. The younger girl, Allie, was a major character in all seasons of Last Man Standing with Tim Allen. I mean, they work.
Okay. Yes, they are working actors.
Yeah, they have their SAG card. They're real people. So again, that signals to me like we're really trying to make this less of a stunt, because obviously the ghost of Blair Witch is hovering over all of this. How do you do it all again and make people fall for it all over again?
I'm just going to say this about these real actors. The unreal actors come back and are not outshone.
Cannot tell the difference.
Yeah, you know what? I'm not even going to disagree with you here. In the end, I see that more as the limitations of the scenarios we're seeing. They didn't abandon found footage. That was one thing that I had speculated on, is maybe they'll only pick up the camera some of the time. Blair Witch 2 did that. Sometimes people are holding cameras and filming each other, and sometimes there's a objective camera view that's watching all of them as any other movie would.
Nope, they always hold that camera, even when it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, well, there's more cameras around. They've rigged a house full of cameras, so at least we don't have to be in the bedroom the whole time.
Yeah, I'm going to slightly disagree. We can go through it, Jacob, but because so much of this is security footage, I never had a problem with why they are filming.
Well, let's find out about it. Arnie, give them the plot. Give them the scenes that were handed to these semi-professional actors. We'll get into Paranormal Activity 2.
Paranormal Activity 2 follows Daniel Ray, his wife Christy, his daughter from a previous marriage, Allie, and the couple's newborn baby, Hunter. Strange things start happening after the couple bring home the new baby boy. Things such as pots falling from their hanger above the counter, and scary things like the pool not being properly vacuumed, as somehow the pool cleaner is taken out of the pool each night.
You know how much chemicals are, chlorine, to get that pH balance straight if that skimmer's not going every night? What a nightmare.
Oh God, it's a dink horror. The couple's Hispanic nanny, Martine, tries some hoodoo to ward off some evil spirits, for which Daniel fires her.
Despite Christie and Allie's insistence something strange is going on, Daniel wants no part of their supernatural talk. The events continue to escalate as Allie both tries to contact the spirit through a Ouija board and reads books on demons. As she reads that humans and demons can strike a bargain, the human gets wealth and power, but the demon gets the firstborn son in the lineage. And Hunter is the first male born to her bloodline in nearly 70 years. So I think what we're being told here is Oren Peli made a deal with a demon and better not have a boy.
Or he'll have to live with Area 51.
So now the demon is hunting Hunter. Christie confides about these events to her sister, Katie, from the first movie. This is a prequel to that film, and as we know from the first movie, Christie and Katie had been haunted as children, but Katie tells Christie just ignore the happenings and they'll go away. But they don't. The demon hurts the family dog, then possesses Christie. Desperate, Daniel calls back Martine. The nanny says the spirit can be removed. Christie and Hunter can be saved, but the demon must latch on to another family member, which would be Christie's sister, Katie. Martine does the ritual, and then we see some footage from the first film of Katie and her boyfriend Mika as they start to be haunted. And then we jump ahead to the night after a possessed Katie killed Mika. Now she breaks into Daniel's house and breaks his neck. She also kills Christie and takes Hunter and leaves. Allie returns home from a school trip to find her parents dead and her brother missing, as credits roll.
Okay, so the question is, as you popped in this movie, however you watched it, I don't know if you guys saw theatrical or extended, but they more or less begin the same way. When did you know that Katie and Mika were showing up?
When they showed up?
Yeah, I figured it was going to tie in when they started with the dates being in 2006. I'm like, okay, they're tying into this first movie because this movie's coming out in, what, 2010?
Mm-hmm.
So the only reason to date it 4 years earlier is to put it at the same time of the events of the previous movie. I didn't remember the exact days and dates of the previous movie well enough to know immediately that this was a prequel, but I knew it was still taking place in California around the same time, but I never expected Katie and Mika to show back up until they did.
Okay, because they have one big clue that before you see Katie, you know they're coming. Carlsbad, you know, they start the same way. Paramount wants to thank the families of the deceased and the Carlsbad police force. Carlsbad is what, about 30 minutes from San Diego?
Yeah, it's just north of San Diego.
Yeah, so they're close enough that maybe you think they're coming, maybe you don't. But as this baby Hunter is being brought home and we see the nanny coming down the stairs, the photo of Katie and Mika is there. It's just in the background, but these found footage movies kind of live and die by what you can see in the margins. And if you're an eagle eye, you would know within the first minute that this Christie is Katie's sister. You might also remember that name from the first movie as well. She mentioned her once.
I remember Katie mentioned having a sister. I didn't catch the name Christie, so I did not catch this relation until it's made explicit. But this scenario, hey, we just had a baby, completely makes me believe why so much is being filmed, because having had sisters who had babies, the novelty of the camera, I always ask, when are the children ever going to watch this 300 hours of footage you have filmed? When will they sit down to relive this first year of their childhood, of which every moment was committed to camera? But yes, I completely understand the father going around and filming Hunter coming home. And
I have a question, because there's a few times I get kind of confused with how much time has lapsed in this. Is this all, like, taking place from the day the baby arrives home? Because within a few scenes, that baby's like 6 months old, at least. I'm like, there's no way that's a newborn now.
No, I think we're actually in the year 2005. I don't think it gets properly identified. When the nights actually begin, when they actually are counting them, night one, night two, and all of that, it's got to be at least a year beyond the baby coming home.
Yeah, it's very big. And, I mean, just this whole family dynamic, because there's a daughter, and I put older sister originally in my notes, Allie, and I'm like, she's got to be like 13 to 15 or something. That mom seems very young. Oh, that's the sister of I totally missed that, like, this is a whole step-parent situation. I do feel like if this is going to be about characters and these are our eyes into this weird world of paranormal activity, I should be able to understand them a little bit better. Because they are doing the found footage thing, I don't know, I always feel like I'm trying to puzzle these things together throughout the film.
I'll agree with you, Jacob, in the beginning. I was just really working to keep track of who was who and how they related to each other. But what we're supposed to take it is this father's an older guy and got himself a young wife to start a second family with.
Yes, I figured it out eventually.
He bought into the Burger King franchise. It's a drop line that's maybe only in the extended cut. I don't know. Did you guys hear that?
I didn't, but I watched the extended cut. I must have just missed the Burger King reference.
Yeah, that one did not jump out at me for some reason.
Yeah, when we see Mika later, he's talking about how he went into Burger King and dropped Daniel's name. And they're like, they didn't give me free food. Why didn't they give me free food? And Daniel's like, I don't own them all. So, yes, I think... Fast food king, he gets a younger, hotter wife, but the daughter from the other marriage comes along. I like the fact that you have to figure that out. In fact, I would say that that is a good thing to do. We don't want to just be sitting here waiting for the doors to be swinging open and closed. We want to be able to try and figure out what's going on and why people are filming the moments that they are. And you're right, Arnie, filming a newborn coming home and everyone taking a turn holding them makes a lot of sense. And then, yeah, the next time we're filming them, it's like a year's time and the place has been broken into.
One question. In between that time, they film a pool party. There's some boy in the pool.
That's Brad. That's Allie's boyfriend.
Okay, that's Brad, and we're going to see him again later. Okay.
Yes.
I couldn't figure out who this boy was, and I even, in the subtitles, when he talks, it just says boy. And so I couldn't figure out who this kid was. And meanwhile, somebody else is saying, I'm the wicked step aunt. And so I'm like, is this a cousin?
Wait, that's Katie. You didn't recognize Katie?
I didn't expect Katie, so therefore I didn't recognize Katie.
Oh, see, that's the big jump. It's like Katie is there when the baby comes home. There's a weird moment where someone's like, someone left the front door open. We're thinking ghost or demons. And all of a sudden, knock, 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 there she is. That would be the moment I would think any fan would recognize, oh, this is the sister. They are picking up direct threads and telling us backstory.
But the thing is, I know I just watched that first one last week, but I know 2006, I can tell you what month it took place in. So I was trying to figure that out once I realized, oh, okay, Katie's here. Is this afterwards? Now they're going to tell us exactly when this is going to take place eventually, but yeah.
Someone asked her, why isn't Mika here? And she's like, oh, he wasn't up to coming. And we're like, is it because he's dead?
Yeah.
I mean, eventually he shows up. Again, it's a teasing game of, okay, it's her, but is this exactly? Has she already killed and they haven't found out yet? Probably not. But yeah, they keep you on your toes here.
See, and I know I just watched it a week ago, but in the shaky cam we're getting, it doesn't linger on her enough. And then she's wearing sunglasses where I didn't quite catch it was Katie until later on.
Okay, I mean, I recognized her instantly. And again, I guess I was the one that thought it would be the tie. I even cited, hey, she had a sister in the past. We probably are going to follow her. This is all feeling right to me. This feels like exactly where you were going if you were going to make a quickie sequel. Find a way to work in the characters from last time, but don't make them the focus. It won't be the search for Katie. It'll be the story of Christy and actually how Katie got cursed. But we don't know that yet.
Last week, it all felt about it was Katie. She was the one who the figurey shadow would stand at the end of her bed. But now it's like going all after Christy. So I'm like, as someone that has to pay attention to the continuity for these reviews, I'm not impressed like intellectually, but I'm like, okay, it's smart. Throw a curveball, but keep it in the family. Like, it works.
Three screenwriters, they got into something.
I'm comparing this to Saw 2 because Saw was a huge hit. And then in 1 year, they had to crank out a quickie sequel. And what they did was grab a spec script and rewrite a couple of characters and try to make it fit in the Saw mythology. And it's always the one that sticks out as the redheaded stepchild of the Saw family. So the fact that they were able to take this and create some continuity with the family and things and do it in a way that surprised me at the end, I'm going to give
whoever did it, the three screenwriters, director, producers, whatever, kudos on knocking out a story that does tie in so well and is actually interesting in relation to the first film, builds upon it in a very short time span.
Well, there was a lot to be built. I'm just going to argue it wouldn't be satisfying to me to make sequels that never went back and told us what that demon was. Like, we're owed this. And so I'm feeling like, good. When we jump, and the next time they're picking up a camera to tape anything, it's because they've been burglarized, or so they think. And this serves a triple purpose. One, it tells you the demon's here.
Is it? The demon does so little for the next hour of the film. I wondered if this really was a burglary.
Well, interesting. Maybe it is.
Yeah, what really confused me is that, you know, they're all looking around, what's been taken. Oh, all the jewelry's here. This is weird. That's telling me, this is a demon thing. And they're like, let's check the basement. I'm like, no, there's no houses in California with a basement.
But that's another purpose. I do think we need to know the location. If this is going to be taking place in the house and it's not the same house as before. I mean, last time it didn't even take place in the house. It was a bedroom. And then downstairs, they sometimes were in the living room occasionally. But here, we need to see all the spaces. There's more characters, there's more rooms. And so they're going room to room to see what got burglarized. And that teaches the audience where everything is going to be.
I thought their basement got burglarized, but no, these are just some hoarder motherfuckers. They've got cardboard boxes falling upon each other to the ceiling. And they're like, oh, nothing's been touched down here.
But of course, the real purpose, the best purpose for all of this, and I think pretty ingenious, is, hey, if we've been broken into, we need security cameras. And so this movie is going to improve on the last one just by being able to go hop around rooms organically. There are 5 new cameras throughout this house that we can cut to at any given moment, and we're not stuck on a tripod.
And the home security install guy is a much better actor than the psychic from the previous film.
Well, again, probably a SAG member.
I'll take Abby the dog over that guy last week, yeah.
But, I mean, this guy doing the home security install is not giving the performance of a lifetime. He does feel like maybe they got a home security install guy who wants to be an actor.
Or maybe just someone from the crew. He looks like a grip, you know, frankly. Come in, you're in the shot now. You're in the movie, you're going to get paid.
He's not even going to take the sunglasses off his head. He's just going to come in wearing the clothes he had while he was holding the mic or whatever. But yes, I agree. The security footage is a great way to go about it and takes away some of that burden again of why are they filming? They're constantly filming. I don't know what privacy laws are in California. I know when I started installing Ring cameras in Illinois, wiretap laws and recording laws are brutal, and you actually can't really do that without having everyone who comes to your home sign a piece of paper.
Well, within the home, that's private property. It's recording on the phone, I know, is two-party consent in California, but I think if you're in your home, you can film whatever you want.
You can, but if somebody comes to your house and has a reasonable expectation of privacy in your house, in Illinois, it's a felony to film them.
Yeah, if they're breaking in, I don't think they should have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
I'm saying when they have Katie over, if this was Illinois, Katie would have to sign a waiver. So
that sounds like a boring movie. More so than this.
But this is structured like the last movie. They're not going to change what worked for them. We are going to have a series of nights in which paranormal activity builds and builds.
Where the pool light turns off, and every night we cut to that pool, and only once do the lights go off, and it took me forever to realize, oh, we got to establish that the filter, the skimmer is going around, and that it's not in there in the morning. Like, it took me a few nights to finally get why every night opened up with that pool shot.
But that's good. Again, that's the way found footage works. It doesn't jump scare you. It, like, is this thing that's going on, and then you realize, you make that connection after the fact. That's what I believe is effective about it. And you like subtle. I know that you're kind of grumpy about this, but I've heard you compliment the strangers when the guy is just like in the background all of a sudden. Those can be some of the best scares.
Yeah, because you know what? That's a dude with an axe. That's scary. The skimmer getting pulled out of the pool is not scary.
Yeah, I don't know if this is intentional or unintentional comedy, but I am laughing that the ghost is just a slight pestering with the pool skimmer.
The dad is going to, like, somehow rig that thing to shoot itself out to try to explain all this. Like, it's so ridiculous how much time is devoted to this skimmer.
I mean, okay, yes. I would say it's ridiculous how much time we have to build up. I would say that was equally true of the last movie.
Yes!
And probably all of the next movies.
They have not learned that lesson.
Found footage is a tough genre to make work for feature length because, frankly, there's just not enough good, scary material to go 80, 90 minutes.
Maybe churning out a couple, 20,000 more, get a little bit of writer, like to write some scares. That's all I want is actual scary stuff. That could happen as a found footage film. It doesn't need to be footsteps. And that is the shock to me of this film is that we're not going to see no demon. It's going to just be noises again.
Think about the first Cloverfield. We don't have to spend an hour doing nothing.
Yeah, but you also have to have $35 million. And that's a different level of production than this.
I just want a ghost, something you can see. I'm not asking for a monster.
First of all, it's not a ghost. It's a demon.
A demon. Yeah, I know.
And second of all, I would say for sure, 100%, we're going to get more information about it than we did last time. We are definitely going to get more backstory on this demon than what wasn't there in the darkness in Paranormal Activity 1. First of all, we know where it is. From the very first night, Abby the dog is pawing at the basement door. And if you remember during the break-in, they went down there and there was like a funny smell and all of that. That was really telling me, okay, the demon lives down here and it's going to be coming out periodically to, yeah, maybe take a dip in the pool and then go into the nursery.
And we're having some of those same things from last time, you know, the doors creaking and things, but the larger family helps with this because now you've got more people experiencing things. Like, there's the scene where something is really rancid smelling in the bathroom. And did Allie take a nasty shit or was a demon in there?
That's what I was wondering. Yeah. Like, why are you filming the really bad shit your daughter took? It's very strange.
Again, I would call that a false alarm, a cat jumping out kind of moment. It's like someone screamed, oh my God, running to it. And it just turns out that, yeah, she's just overreacting to a smelly turd. And whether that's a paranormal turd or not remains ambiguous. I'm fine with not seeing the demon. As much as badly as I might want to see the demon, I don't need to see him on the job.
But it's around this time that Katie comes back over, and that's when I'm like, oh, Katie, now I get it.
Yeah, she's actually on night two, the one to comfort Hunter. Because if you notice, Christy has short hair, and then we have night two cut, and a woman with long hair is holding the child and trying to get him to stop crying in the nursery. And we're like, who the hell is that? And then, yeah, next morning you realize Mika and Katie have come over. That's when you get the Burger King stuff and all the backstory. They really do link the fact that it's the sister she talked about in Paranormal 1.
And I like the fact that they make it very blatant. They just put on the screen in that font 60 days before the death of Mika Sloat. First of all, I never knew Mika had a last name. It's Sloat. But second of all, okay, now I know we have 2 months until he dies. And so how do they tie into this? What's going to happen here? Are we going to see his death in this film?
As just someone watching the continuity between these films, this film's not engaging me very much, but I do like, it plants the seed, like, that this is where Mika got the idea for these cameras. Like, he's like, oh, let me see that. Like, he's very interested in Daniel's camera.
Not just the camera, but like this is how he gets to find out that his wife has a history with paranormal activity. Like up to that point, there was no knowledge of that. So all of this is because things are going wrong here.
Yeah, and I was looking for continuity slip-ups because he did say in that last one that that was the first time he heard this story, but that was the stuff about her as a kid that does not get revealed here. So again, tight continuity. They watched the previous one.
Okay, you caught that? I was wondering. I felt like maybe they cheated that a little bit.
No, I felt like it was a fair call.
All right.
But the first couple nights are like, yeah, the mobile above the crib is turning and nothing's there. Or one time, it's only in the extended version, but we're just watching the nursery and I'm like, ooh, the door's moving. And then I'm like, oh, no, it's not.
My girls were doing that. Like, they were so intensely staring into the screen. They're like, wait, was that pillow there before? Yes. Did that just show up? I'm like, no, it was there the whole time, guys. Come on.
Yes, I'm telling you, once again, I found myself not blinking during these things. I'm like looking for everything, trying to find slight movement and everything. And I keep telling myself I'm not going to miss it. It's going to draw itself out to me, but I still find myself searching every pixel of this.
If it's pulling you in that much again, where you're looking at every pixel, like, are you as scared as you were last time? Before, you said you were afraid of the dark after that film. Like, are you getting as drawn in with this one? Are you at the same level?
Well, the last film didn't really get me scared until, like, the last half hour. So I'm equally as interested at this point. I'm liking the characters again. I'm liking the family dynamic. The first hour of both these films is spending time with these families, and how much I just enjoy watching them bicker and chat is very impactful on if I'm checking my watch or not during this. And while I'll say the first hour of this movie is way too slow, I'm okay with it. I'm kind of going along with it. And when the night happens, I'm anxious. I'm wanting something to happen.
And I would say that this is better. Clearly, easily, much better than last week, because there's just more people. There's more people to have drama with. There's more things going on because there's a teenage daughter, because they have a maid, and she's lighting incense and trying to do things to clear out the bad spirits, and that's upsetting the father.
Why do they get rid of her for that? Does the incense that she gets just smell bad? Like, that seemed very harsh. We're like, we're firing you. You want only good spirits in this house? You're fired. We don't like you.
No, this is really good. This is something to hook you. Why is the father so against paranormal activity? Later, we're going to be told some deal was made with a demon. I think you're supposed to think that Daniel is the guy that made that deal.
Yeah, he became a Burger King guy because he made a deal with the demon. Shoot higher.
The demon's like, sure, Burger King stock, and it's going to pay off for you.
I believe it. Look at that Burger King, the grinning one, like the one with the like plastic head. He is totally frightening. Totally a demon. But yeah, I think you're supposed to think that he's got secrets. And the reason why he doesn't want anyone talking about paranormal activity is because he doesn't want anyone digging up what he might have done. That was a false lead that's kind of set up by this beginning.
Yeah, I never thought that.
I didn't ever take it that way. What I took it as is this guy is grounded and just doesn't want this BS in his house. And I thought it was very harsh to fire Martine after one instance of this. Usually you could just say, I don't want that in my house, don't do that again. And after multiple instances, you fire her.
And they never hire another nanny. It's very strange. Like, your wife all of a sudden doesn't need that help?
The character turn that I mentioned earlier that I can't follow is when Dan becomes an asshole and just refuses to listen to anybody about anything regarding this. When they're like, watch the tape, he's like, no, I'm not even going to do that for you, and I'm walking away because I'm a dick.
Again, it would beg the question of what is his relationship with paranormal activity. As his daughter starts investigating how demons come about and how they make pacts with people, I think you're supposed to think he's the dude. That's the intrigue that they're building. And it's just subtle enough.
She doesn't realize that until almost an hour into the movie, though. So we have a whole bunch of this going on before we would even have an opportunity to think that he's involved.
I don't know why you would complain about having breadcrumb trails. You are of all of this behavior that you're going, who's the relationship? What's going on? This is all very good in found footage movies. You want to be asking who these people are and what their motives are, because it's not going to have drama in the most satisfying way. They're not going to be able to stage dramatic scenes the way they would be in any normal movie. So this is, I would say, imperative that we have these kinds of drop clues and inferences and question marks as to motive.
I'd say if Jacob and I both missed them, that their breadcrumb trail was a little too thin. The birds came and picked up the breadcrumbs.
I think they're there. I don't know why you aren't asking the questions. I mean, do you like these characters?
Yes.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, look, all they got to do is have some actual scares instead of sound effects. That's all I'm asking.
And they are heavily betting on their base again this time. My subwoofer's got to work out.
Yeah, I did notice that much more in this one. It sounds like they cranked the bass up or something.
Again, I'm trying to imagine what this would have been like in IMAX. I can't imagine what the experience would be, but like how it looked, how it would sound. Again, the fun would be the audience. That's the one thing I'm missing, is I know that, you know, I said it last time, it's a biological response. You're either scared by the way that the found footage plays on you, or you don't even recognize it as something you should be scared of. I would be able to get into it more if I were seeing other people react.
And I will say there probably is something to that, but there's also something to what I said, is that this is horror for children, because my kids weren't with me when I watched the first one. They were with me this time, and oh boy, were they into it, like, the whole time. Like, again, scanning the screen, every corner, and listening to every sound. And yes, they totally got into that, but that's how they are with everything. Like, they believe everything's going to be a mystery that pays off in a satisfying way.
Well, Jacob, I'm going to clarify. Is it horror for children, or is it horror for a generation that grew up filming themselves? Because I think to say, oh, only kids would be scared of this, is just factually wrong.
Yes, I was scared.
The ticket buying audiences were not 12 and under.
I'm saying I don't know many adults that are scared of sounds.
And yet there are many adults scared of this movie.
I understand that. It confounds me.
I'm going to argue one of the scariest things you can do to a person is walk up behind them and pop a balloon. You are very likely to give them a heart attack.
You could also just jump in front of them with an axe. Like, it's a surprise.
I hear you want stakes, and I feel like found footage isn't built on them. So I feel for you. I kind of am in between. I feel like as long as the craft is good, I like inference. I like being able to predict what's in the dark. I don't need to be shown everything. It doesn't have to be literal. It doesn't have to be jump scares. But it does have to be more than pool cleaners. I do feel like, yeah, so much of what they have to do is stall before they can really get to the movie. So you really do have an hour of twiddling your thumb.
And you talk about you're very impressed that now they got security cameras so we could see more rooms, but I didn't see that Tokyo Night thing, but you were talking about that split screen. Do we ever get like a split screen shot? I feel like, yeah, play up that security camera thing. Do something innovative. I just feel like, oh, we got more cameras, but we're just doing the exact same thing with them.
I agree. I watched Tokyo Night first, and I really wished they'd do some of that split screen coolness here and more of the fast forward cameras than they do. There's not a lot of the fast forward cameras early on because there's nothing to fast forward to early on.
Yeah, so let's just kind of run down the things that we're seeing. First of all, worth pointing out, the Katie photograph is here. And is that because of Paranormal Activity? Christy thought all of her old photographs burned up in the house fire from the 80s. And in fact, there's one mixed up in here with Hunter's pictures.
And that was like one of the few scenes in the last movie where, again, scary probably isn't the right word. It's campfire story scary. And like now that kind of mystique was ruined. It's like, oh, this sister had the photo and we're going to see exactly how it got burned and all that. Before, the implication was, oh, here's something that should have burned in that house fire that just magically appeared above your bed.
Right. I think that this is non-paranormal, but at this point, early in the movie, we're jumping to the conclusion that it must be Paranormal Activity. It did burn up in the fire, and now it's in Hunter's pictures, and ooh, but I actually just believe, I don't know, maybe it is Paranormal Activity, but we will see non-paranormal things done with this photograph at the climax of this movie, when Daniel takes the reins and decides to switch the curse. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. First, we got, yeah, a whole lot of doors opening, that thrum happening. I think the child is seeing things that other people aren't. He seems transfixed by the mirror or the ceiling or maybe the window.
I kept watching the bedroom mirror to see if like you could see some shadow or something in that, but nope, they couldn't even do that for me.
They have a conversation where Christy is saying, Hunter's looking at something, and it sure wasn't me. I can't tell what it was. So, yeah, it can see the demon.
The baby monitor crackles. I mean, some of them just, again, it feels like a grab bag. It feels like they just, like, filmed a whole bunch of stuff. Stuff we've all seen before. Stuff that's in Insidious. Stuff that was in Poltergeist. Stuff that was in a million horror movies. The gimmick of it is that it's been put in this found footage context. So that will either work for you or it won't. But it doesn't feel fresh. It doesn't feel like what's happening to this family feels particularly special. If anything, it feels like a foregone conclusion that they're going to be attacked by a demon. But first, pans have to fall.
I've seen this in a previous film, and I can't remember which one, where the falling pan that was hanging above a stove was indicative of a ghost, but I love that Dan is like, you just didn't put it on there right. Blame the victim.
Total mansplaining thing to do, yeah.
And then later it catches fire on the stove, and again, we're thinking about fire being connected with this family. Will it burn down the house? No, he comes down and throws it in the pool. I actually had to do that recently. I didn't realize that this is how house fires start. I didn't know that your pan could just get that hot and to catch fire. But at any rate, again, they're walking that line of it isn't necessarily paranormal. You could understand why a skeptic could live in this and not be freaking out. It's really Christy, because of her history, because she's had these kinds of things happen to her before, and worse, that she's maybe jumping to the conclusion that it's starting all over again.
Things really start to kick up after the dad finds Allie and Brad in the hot tub.
Yeah, that's when he's putting out the fire. That's when he's realizing the pool skimmer is coming out. Some of this is only extended cut, though. I want to point out there's a delightful scene, I'm being sarcastic, where he goes for a swim in the hot tub and I guess gets his balls boiled and has to put like frozen peas on it. Not in the theatrical version.
Okay, so that was part of the extended. Here's my problem. I bought the bundle from iTunes so I could watch these movies, and I bought the unrated cuts without realizing they're also extended cuts. And I'm going to say the best thing you could do for any of these movies so far is shorten them. So watching the extended cuts is not helping my experience here with Paranormal Activity 2.
Agreed. And again, the tapes up to this point, they've given us our purview, but it takes them a while before this family realizes, hey, maybe we should check the tape. And when they do, we actually see the pool skimmer like crawl out on its own. Like, it is kind of nifty the way it just, it reminds me of those early scenes in Poltergeist where they have Carol Ann being pulled across the kitchen floor with a football helmet on. Of like, this is kind of fun that we have a ghost. I hope we do. Like, you can see the daughter is really like, I want to have a haunted house. This will make my social life more interesting.
But a pool skimmer that just crawls out of the pool is not Carol Ann being dragged across a kitchen floor. This is a malfunctioning device. It's not like it levitates out of the middle of the pool and is set on the side of the pool. This thing just drives itself out of the pool. It's not scary in the least. It is amusing.
Again, it's that line of like, you could either explain it away, you could be Daniel and say, oh, it's just being proactive, ha ha ha. Or you could be Allie and be like, I'm going to Google all about this and see what the demon is.
Yes, that's a perfect scene for the 30-minute mark as we enter in Act 2.
Agreed. Poltergeist, that is 20 minutes into the movie. And then Carol Ann gets grabbed. Then you up the stakes. And I do think that normally you might want to think about having Hunter grabbed at the 30-minute mark. And instead, it's the whole movie.
I feel my tension starting to rise at about 45 minutes in the unedited cut, because that's when Allie breaks out the Ouija board. And I remember what was said by that bad psychic in the last movie, don't try to communicate or things are going to escalate. And I'm like, yes, please, escalate.
They're going to escalate with their boyfriend for sure.
Yeah, the ghost wants some pussy.
Yeah.
At least that's what the boyfriend has spelled out on the Ouija board.
But again, how many movies have we seen where they break out the Ouija board? This is so not fresh. The only thing that makes it fresh is that it's done in this found footage way. And so, yes, the fact that he originally makes it say something vulgar and then insists, and she won't believe, that he's not moving it when it spells H-U-N-T to answer, what do you want?
Pussy hunt? That's exactly what he's doing.
Yeah, well, maybe it's a pussy hunt, but obviously when they cut up to the nursery cam and we see Hunter in his crib, it's telling us, just in case you think it is a pussy hunt, no, Hunter.
Oh, no, it's very effective. Again, my girls flipped out. They're like, oh, it's after the baby.
I wish it would go for the baby. I mean, again, if this movie could get to it, it would be on such better footing. But I guess, I don't know. What would be the problem with having the baby grabbed at this point?
It's not the formula. They're obviously sticking to the formula of the last one. They don't want sudden escalation and then resolution. They want a down ending.
They don't want anything exciting.
I mean, the baby does get grabbed. It's worth saying that, like, something comes for it in that night.
Right.
It goes, pulls it across the crib and pulls it out. But then he's just, like, walking around. It's very strange.
I feel like in these movies, the demon needs to gather power and build up to the eventual possession. And so here, he's just at medium strength and able to knock down some pans and levitate some babies. But, hey, $3 million budget. One of the problems I had with the last film is all they could do was close a door and catch a Ouija board on fire. Now, at least you can green screen a baby floating.
I wish we had more of that. Is Dan just against reviewing any footage? Like, weird stuff happens. Go check all that security footage. Go see that baby floating out of its crib. I wanted to see that scene.
Yeah, there was a lot of money spent on the security system he refuses to look at. But I'll agree with you, Jacob, as far as the why are they filming this? Why are they filming themselves watching footage filmed? Very meta.
Yeah, I think you want to create tension between the household. You want to have people disagree about the best course of action. That Allie, who was originally like, oh, I really want it there to be a ghost. I want to talk to it on the Ouija board. The fact that some shadow falls on her while she's sleeping on the couch and whispers in her ear and then locks her out of the house. She's quickly on to the idea that, okay, this is not something you want in your house. And she's going to go off and do the Google search. If we don't have the psychic coming in to give us explanations and expository information, or again, if you've never seen a horror movie before at all and need to have explained what a demon is, that's what she does here when she gets on the internet. And the quote is, "It has been said if a human has made a bargain with a demon for wealth, power, or Burger King," again, I'm going to insist, "or benefit, they must forfeit their first born male. If the debt is not honored, the demon will follow the defaulter and his or her brood until the soul of the infant is collected."
I got questions. Like, if you're past your childbearing years, will the demon still make a deal with you? Because I think I found a loophole and I want to make a deal. I want some riches.
Yeah, but then it follows your bloodline.
I don't have any blood kids, so good luck, demon. Again, loophole. Does he know this if I just revealed my hand to him?
I think you just screwed yourself.
I'm not ever thinking the father did this, especially since I know the Christie connection.
Well, the father couldn't have done it because maybe he wasn't the firstborn. Maybe he had a brother that died.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking about it too clearly. I didn't have mapped out family trees, but I was just like, this father and the way that he's always saying, "I don't want to believe," makes me think that he's got the skeleton in his closet. Like, the reason is that he did something and he doesn't want to. Who wants to remember that they made a deal with the devil 30 years later?
I'm going to turn a table on you, Stuart. You say that this movie's leaving breadcrumbs and Jacob and I are missing them. I'm going to say this movie's dull and you're really hypothesizing craziness that I don't think the movie's really intending.
I definitely think three screenwriters were coming up with storylines.
Okay, I agree. Three screenwriters came up with storylines.
Yeah, there were ideas. And again, if you're not doing this work and trying to fill in huge blanks, I don't know what you're doing in a found footage movie. Like, that is what found footage is about. How do I connect this scrap of film with that scrap of film? What did I miss in the ellipsis? That's where the movie lives. It doesn't live with what it shows you. It lives with what isn't there that you have to put together in your mind.
I'll agree partially, but part of it is what it shows you in the midst of things. It's almost a Where's Waldo of horror. And also, I just never suspected this father is the thing. Even when she's on that Google search, which kudos to them for making Google look like it did in 2006, really shitty with blue links. I never was thinking the father because I'm like, something is up with Katie and Christie's bloodline here. So when you're talking about bloodlines and curses, I'm looking at the stepmom.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it's Katie and Christie, and we know they have a history since they were 8 and 5 of seeing ghosts. That's part of the other reason I'm never suspecting Daniel.
You guys are right. I wasn't concentrating on that until day 18 when Christie actually says, "Hey, I'm going to call Katie over here." And yeah, we get just a little bit of description. Basically, Katie doesn't want to talk about it. She says, whatever it was, it thrived on fear. So the more you pay attention to it, the worse it gets. Leave it alone, or, and this part is interesting, you'll end up just like mom.
I caught that line. They never explain what that is, so I'm hoping maybe they'll continue in a sequel with that.
I told you there's an 80s one. I don't know when it comes, but we will go back to the 80s and see this. So I think we're getting really close to it. It's not this movie, but you're right. Obviously, what happened to them in childhood that killed their mother or made their mother go crazy or whatever. You're being asked by subtle inference here to fill in the story. Basically, yes, this is her childhood demon coming back to her. And I guess you're right. The more that people are getting afraid, the more powerful it can become. And so when we have what's, in my estimation, the best jump scare of the movie, now everyone's tense. Christy goes to read a magazine in the kitchen, and all of a sudden, every cabinet door blows open.
That was fun. You know, I can't say I was scared by it, but man, it was fun to just see everything fly out like that all at once, coordinated. It was just a really cool effect. I liked that one.
Mm-hmm. I'm not ashamed to say it got me. Jacob, didn't you jump a little? I mean, it's surprising. It's well-timed.
Yeah, it's well-timed, but again...
Not a guy with an axe, I know.
No, but at least this was visual. I'll give it that. But every time, because I know how this film works, the whole point is to hold a scene and then something's going to happen, whether it's a little something moving or a sound or something. So I'm always prepared for something. This was a bigger thing, though, to happen. I wish, again, 30, 40 minutes earlier, stuff like this at this level had escalated.
But also, it's much bigger than they could afford to do in the first movie, so I find it... more satisfying in that way. It doesn't feel constrained. And also, I will disagree. They constantly rotate through those cameras of nothing happening. And so I'm used to long stretches of nothing happening, which is great because we talked about the Insidious films. We talked about the Conjuring films. I hate it when I can just count the beat. 1, 2, 3. Now everybody's going to scream because here's the scare. And I can count till it comes and know exactly when it's coming. Here, they keep me on my toes, and I can never fully brace myself against a jump scare because it happens just after so long of nothing.
So you're liking this. I feel like you like this, but then you say things that you're really bored by it.
The more we get towards the climax, the less bored I get, but it takes a long time to get there.
So also true of the first movie. And I hear you say, I only liked the last half hour.
I enjoyed the time spent with that couple. But yeah, it got much better as the scares got bigger.
I mean, we don't learn a whole lot. But isn't it more satisfying that we have someone Googling things and being like, there's a newborn male curse and a no featherstone boy has been born since the 1930s. Like, we needed more of this in the first movie. We needed more angles. We needed more lore. There's a difference between minimal and empty, and that first movie was more or less empty.
I mean, I feel like they're doing the sequel thing. We're taking the little breadcrumbs that were dropped during that little improv scene with the psychic in that first one, and I don't feel like this is so incredibly creative that it deserves a whole lot of praise. I feel like you're coming on a little strong, like inference. No, it's we did the minimal amount of writing we need to do to tell the story. Like, you guys piece it together. Like, I don't think it deserves that kind of praise just because, yes, it expands the lore in a pretty consistent, satisfying way, but it is nowhere near, like, masterful. Like, most people would probably come up with this.
I didn't say masterful. You're bending my words. I'm saying this movie is better than Paranormal Activity because it's working harder.
I'll agree with that. In that way, is it as scary? No, because it's working harder. But it doesn't feel as raw, but it does feel more polished, and I do like... Did I catch Allie right when she said it must be Hunter's great-grandmother who made this bargain back in the 30s?
I didn't hear that exact language, but if it were the last male, like, maybe it was the grandfather.
Yeah, they said great-grandmother at one point, and so I'm like, okay, so that would be...
Yeah, I wrote down great-grandmother.
Here's what I know. We can't go back to that time unless somebody is like a silent movie maker. Like, I don't
just constantly cranking that camera.
Yeah, you could only have it in like certain rooms, like they were pretty heavy and stationary.
Nickelodeon ghosts.
Yeah, I don't think that we're going to get the found footage 1930 movie.
I want a history, an education of film by the decade as told through Paranormal Activity. That's what I want.
Yeah, if maybe if they made it on a soundstage in Hollywood, you could do it in the 1930s.
Yeah, 80s will feel like a Spielberg movie. And yes, just take me through this history of cinema through Paranormal Activity.
That would be very cool, actually.
Sound would just be invented. You'd have to have intertitles while everyone talked. You could even do the sound effects of footsteps. You just have to hold up a card that says footsteps.
Just have some guy with a chalkboard writing down what they're saying.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to get that movie. But yes, I'm intrigued about the 30s.
What are you going to do then? Because you don't got no sound to scare us with. You'll have to give us visuals. I want that silent picture now.
My point is that I'm intrigued. I'm thinking about a different decade. I'm thinking about lineage. I'm thinking of the 1930s. That first movie didn't even try to tell us what was in the dark. It really didn't.
No. And for what that movie was, I didn't need it to. Now that you're building this into a franchise, yes, I want that. And this is giving me a minimal amount of it.
Yeah. Again, if you heard me say masterpiece, I am not there. This movie is too long. I think I've been saying that a lot. It is suffering the problems that most found footage feature films have. And that is, we don't have enough content to make this interesting the whole ride.
But when it gets going pretty fast. I was going to be pretty upset if the dog was killed. The dog, Abby, has been guarding Hunter this whole time, and it's off camera, it's behind the sofa, but you just hear these whimpers and cracks as the dog is being beaten up by the demon. I was, you know, I do sometimes go to doesthedogdie.com to find out if I'm going to watch a movie or not.
Does the dog die? I know they take him away to a vet, and then I know the dad says the next day, I'm going to go and get him, and then I never see the dog again.
He's fine.
I took it as the dog lived but was hurt.
And didn't want to live there again, like found new owners. Like, I ain't going back to that place.
They got him guarding the skimmer in the pool, just in the backyard.
But yes, you're right. The dog being attacked is when you know that the demon is powerful enough to really hurt. And this is also the night that is going to take a bite out of Christy. While they're off running the dog to the midnight vet, she's going to be sitting there on the stairwell, just kind of waiting to find out what happens. And we get a dragging moment. You know, that was the climax of the original film, was like dragging Katie out of the bed. Here, we know that we're getting towards the climax because Christy gets dragged down those stairs.
Yeah, and this is Paranormal Activity 2, Electric Boogaloo, so I need more than dragging. I need more than a bite. Again, you give me this early on because I'm expecting it now. I saw the first one, and you're just repeating it almost at the same lengths of time as well. Like, get to this stuff sooner. If you want to really build lore, you got to add stuff on.
There's a lot more dragging.
Yeah, I guess that's why it's a sequel. It's bigger and better, more dragging.
If you didn't see the movie last week, do you think you would be more into it?
No. Because this is pretty much the movie I did see last week.
Oh, this is definitely better than the first movie.
It is.
There's no way that there's not more filmmaking technique just by having different camera angles. This is more of a movie than what Oren Peli put on a tripod for $15,000.
But is it a better found footage movie? I feel like the more raw, the better. That's why I have a reaction to Blair Witch. That's very raw. I'm way out of it if it's too polished.
I'm with Jacob because I'll just spoil now. This movie didn't scare me. The first movie did. And I think it's part of the rawness and the single camera point of view that got me so invested in that one. And I think this one with the cutting and the editing, it's more polished. It feels like more of a movie. It has more effects. And for all of that, it is a lesser film.
And I will go ahead and spoil that the last movie didn't scare me, and this movie didn't scare me. But let's just get to the climax here. Christy is now possessed. She got bit, and I think that's the point where the demon gets inside you.
Took her into the basement.
Yeah, right. She got dragged to that place where the dog was always barking, that the door opened, and it came out and hurt the dog, and now it's hurt her. And now she's going to be very protective of Hunter. Hunter is going to be crying in his crib, and Allie is going to be left in charge of the child. She's not allowed to touch the kid. Stepmom has gone psycho.
And this is when Daniel has to eat his words and call back Martine. How did that phone call go?
I think it began with a dollar amount. I want back pay. I want health care.
She knew he has those Burger King bucks.
Yeah, I want a Happy Meal. I don't know.
No. Whopper.
Whatever. I don't eat at Burger King or McDonald's. But the point is, yes, she comes back with some olive oil and a crucifix and says, I have your climax. Somehow we can turn this into a switcheroo and throw this unnamed demon onto the trail of Katie.
And is it Allie who's against it then?
Yes. We have just a kind of, I don't know why, if you don't want this known, that you're filming yourself, but on video, we just hear snippets of Daniel putting his foot down and saying, it's my decision, and this is what needs to happen, and Christy will never know that we did this, and Allie is saying it's not right. But we know what's going to happen, because we saw Paranormal Activity 1.
And here I am thinking during this, this is going to be the most anticlimactic ending to a film ever. Everybody lives. We're just going to do an exorcism. The demon's going to go off and infect the sister for the first movie. That's a shitty ending.
Nah, but remember, they told you at the beginning there are bodies. There are bodies in Carlsbad. So some people aren't going to get out of this alive. But maybe it's just Martine. We don't know yet. But Christy's looking pretty bad. When we see her sitting upright in the bed, she's got the vampire teeth that we saw Katie have at the end of the first movie. She's lunging for necks. And yeah, the climax is lights out, kind of Blair Witch all over again. Instead of wandering through a house, going down into the basement, trying to get the wife so you can expel the spirit with the olive oil covered crucifix. She's got the baby too, it should be said.
Yeah, that leads to a struggle in the basement with night vision and the camera falls. The best part is that little Hunter just runs in front of the camera and you just see his chubby baby legs, and then he turns around and runs out. It's like, what the hell happened? What's the baby seeing? I want to see!
I don't think they knew what to do, because there is a cut scene on the DVD that has them escaping the house in an entirely different way, in a poltergeist way. We see this earthquake happening, and Christy is like, oh, we got to go to the nursery. Hunter is not there. They search the house. And when you know it, the swimming pool! And they go to the swimming pool and they see a body at the bottom and dive in. It's not a clown doll. It's some other kind of doll that was just at the base. And they find the kid by the driveway, grab him and drive away. And I think that was meant to be the ending. I guess that ending allows you to feel that this family hasn't done anything morally wrong. I prefer this ending because it does leave us with the quandary of, well, is Daniel wrong? He just wanted to save his family.
Again, I want to just correct the tone of that question. Quandary makes it sound too smart. Like, I wish these were characters where I could see them going through conflicts and debating with themselves that they should pass on this curse. And no, it's just going to be like, yeah, I did this. And then we could go in and infer and have quandaries, but there's no character here. There's Daniel, he could be a dick. He could be a great guy. Who knows? We're never revealed anything about him.
I mean, I think you could make the same case about Blair Witch.
Yes, I understand that, but that one just feels so much more raw. I get pulled into it more, where I'm like, oh yeah, these are real people going through some horrific thing.
Daniel has to take that Katie photo and burn the edges and presumably sneak into her San Diego house and put it in the insulation above her bed.
I think he probably had Martine do that.
Maybe. Again, that was part of the deal. Like, you got to frame him. But again, it is a quandary. I'm not going to apologize for the vocabulary word. Maybe it's a 50-cent word when it should be a penny word. But yes, he has to think about whether saving his child, his son, and his wife is worth, I mean, giving someone a demon is, I don't know, you can't do it lightly.
Yeah, I'll agree with Stuart. In another movie, this could be a half an hour of the movie, of resting with it. It sounds like it could be a Twilight Zone episode. Do I save my family by passing on the demon?
Yeah. I would have liked this movie to not always be found footage and be able to be dramatic and be Insidious or Poltergeist or just a regular horror movie, because I feel like by sticking to the gimmick, it means that they do remain pretty pencil thin. Jacob, you're right to complain about these characters, but I think it's an attribute of all found footage. I've never seen a found footage movie where the characters are deeply felt and can dramatize their conflicts in the way that a regular movie would.
Yeah, but there's many that at least try.
I think they're trying. Again, I don't know why you think this movie is doing nothing.
I never feel like I have a real discussion in this film about anything. It's always there to just set up some scare or to drop some line to pay off some noise later on. Like, I don't feel drama is ever the goal in these films that we've watched thus far.
I mean, I agree. And I think this was, again, pieced together by what's the footage that worked the best. That will be what's in the movie. We will leave out the scene where they dive into the swimming pool because everyone's going to call us out for Poltergeist. We're going to go with, yeah, the idea that we're leading right back into Paranormal Activity. That feels clean. That feels right. Katie even comes over for a visit and they totally gaslight her with like, oh, yeah, no more strange things here. How about your place? Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, but I wondered if Christy took that as, like you said, we're not going to talk about this.
All I know is Katie gets the last laugh. And you're right. We do get to see the October 9th footage after Mika gets thrown against the camera. She comes to get her revenge on what was put on her household.
Okay, now this is the worst part of either Paranormal Activity movie. Dan is asleep on the sofa, and we see Katie come in. And she snaps his neck like she's the Terminator. What the fuck?
Yes, it's so great.
That's so stupid.
I lost it. Just howling with laughter. It's so bad.
Yeah, he's not a very convincing actor in that moment. And yeah.
Neither is she.
You said real actors.
I don't know about him. I don't know where they got him. Maybe he did own a Burger King. Maybe he was the caterer.
Yeah, she's not very convincing either, this non-actress trying to do the I'm Robert Patrick and going to snap your neck because I have super strength now.
And I think they feel like they got to have something thrown at the camera lens. That was the shot. The Spielberg shot went over so well in Paranormal Activity. But it is goofy. It is goofy to see Katie come in there, grab Christy, and throw her against the nursery cam and take that baby.
And we're to take it that that killed Christy? That was... It seemed like more was done to Mika. Like he was killed off screen and then the corpse was flung at the camera.
The comic book confirms that, that he got clawed on the face.
Yeah, so here, that seems a little minimal. But that she takes Hunter and goes where?
Into the third film, I'm guessing?
Yeah, right. And Allie's still alive, so she can continue on this drama. It's just mentioned after the fact that she was not home this night. School trip, lucky girl.
Yeah, some school trip. She's spending the night somewhere. I laughed at that. Very convenient.
She finds the remains of her dad and her stepmom 3 days later. And yeah, we are left wondering, but knowing full well the next chapter is coming, what will it be?
So Jacob Stewart, Jacob... Give me a bigger shock than this movie. Recommend Paranormal Activity 2.
I dare you.
Existentialism. I thought a lot about existentialism. Who are we in this universe? What is cinema? That's a big question going on right now. What is cinema? Martin Scorsese, Ridley Scott. They say it's not superheroes. Many disagree. And I'll give the MCU. It's cinema. Paranormal Activity, though. Is this cinema? This is what Scorsese needs to be railing against. Look, I like Jackass. I watch that on TV every now and then when it was on. I'm not going to go pay cinema prices to go watch pranks. Unless you're going to try to argue that's a great piece of Dadaist cinema. There are things that are not cinema. So there is this spectrum. Like, there's Jackass, and then you get, like, Bad Grandpa, where it's, like, half Jackass, but we're going to fit a narrative. And then even further on that scale, you have something like The Dictator with Sacha Baron Cohen, where he did Bruno and he did Borat and then he did The Dictator. And you're like, oh, you're not really doing the pranks now. You're just doing a straight narrative film. And like Paranormal Activity, I guess because it's close to that, because these are actors, these aren't just pranks being done on actual people. But I still feel like the purpose of this is a carnival ride. It is to get some kind of adrenaline rush. I definitely saw that in my girls as they watched this. So again, yeah, show it to children. Maybe it's scary. I don't know. It's not cinema. You quote me there. I'll fight all you Paranormal Activity fans. Martin's going to back me up. I know that. Ridley's going to back me up. I'm going to email him, but not cinema and not recommended.
Stewart.
Yeah, Jacob, I think you're right to link that to some of the other things going on in comedy at the time, where it really was about being punked. This does feel like something Katie has a line at one point. She says, the more we talk about it, the worse it gets. This really isn't meant to be scrutinized. It really is about shock value and buying into the aesthetic of found footage. Like, that's where it lives. And it's too bad that there isn't more of a story. I'll say this much, and I've been saying this much. There is more here in Paranormal Activity 2 than there was in Part 1. It's applied by an atomizer. Like, it's misted on.
Okay, thank you for saying the appropriate amount of praise.
Yes. Squirt, squirt. Don't want to put on too much. But it's there now, where I'm now starting to be able to at least gauge of what it might be in the dark that they're not showing us. And I think that's important to do. I think, again, it's a real skill when you're doing something minimal is knowing when you're doing too little. And that first movie did way too little. And here they're trying to correct that. The more money, the professional storytellers are working hard to try and continue what worked with the first movie while giving us something more. And I can only hope by the time we get to the seventh movie, we might actually have a plot that would be combined all seven movies, and it's like the plot you'd expect in a single movie. I like the new angles. As silly as that sounds, I like being able to move around the house. It's less constricted, a little more artful in its presentation and its editing. I wish I liked the actors. I think ultimately why I can't even eke it over. I thought about better might be a recommend, but it's really not because I don't like these people. If they were the Freeling family, if this really were Poltergeist, then I would care about who is being afflicted by these demons. But because I don't, and I never have, and maybe that's the actors, and maybe that's just the medium itself not allowing them to be fully realized characters, people that are always just mugging for a camera are not cute to me.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, in found footage, you're not really going to get arcs.
Well, yeah, again, it's a lot of people holding the camera and going, blah, 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 you know, what people do when they hold cameras. And selfies are not a movie. You're right, this is not cinema. It's getting closer to that, but it's not cinema. And so I would say mild not recommend. I'm pretty ambivalent, but in the end, a few decent little jump moments is not enough to say this.
And I agree with Stuart in that this film is trying to be more. I mean, we had the discussion last week that what Spielberg wanted to do was take that cheapo movie and remake it. Bring in paid actors who have acted before. Bring in a union crew, you know? Let's pay as much as we can for this film. And I feel to a degree that's what happened here, is this is the same story as the last one, with some twists and turns. And again, I just want to say, these actors, whoever they are, did not stand out among the non-actors. I think of Sleepaway Camp 5, I think it was, where they had some real performers, like from The Sopranos, and then the people who were in Sleepaway Camp 1, and it was painful to watch because the real actors could emote and deliver lines, and the ones from Sleepaway Camp 1 felt like they just walked out of a con. I don't mean a con artist thing, although that too, maybe. But I was thinking a convention.
Yeah. You want to talk about cons? Found footage.
So here, they're trying to remake the first one with more money, and yes, they're giving us more characters, and yes, we're getting more camera angles, and yes, we're getting more lore. All good things that undermine the rawness of what the last movie had. This one just feels too slick in certain regards. And I didn't get scared, but it made me realize, and I'm reflecting on the first movie, was I scared? Because here's what I would describe for this movie, I realized. I'm unnerved. It is unnerving to constantly have bass rumbling and loud noises thrust upon you. It's like having a dog bark for 2 hours straight. It's not scary, but it gets under your nerves. Very unnerving. I felt unnerved by this film, which is not the same as being scared by this film.
I wonder, are you working a backwards not recommend on that first movie? It's starting to sound like it.
I'm not changing that arrow. I'm just merely stating that as I re-experience basically the same thing a second time, I'm not scared, but I realize it is still causing adrenaline to surge, but not out of fear.
It's just out of pure primal response to being bludgeoned by sound.
Yeah, I agree. If I made a movie in which I dragged my nails across a chalkboard, it would upset a lot of people, and no one would call it a good horror movie.
Exactly, and that's kind of what's going on here.
I don't know, you might make $300 million and get a whole franchise out of it.
I'm getting on this right now.
I mean, I'll give you the $15,000. I'll gamble $15,000 on that.
It'll be the best chalkboard you've ever seen.
But in the end, I didn't hate this movie. I kind of enjoyed being pulled in by the sister relationship. And I think where the difference comes, Stuart, is I kind of liked the family dynamic and seeing these four people interact, or three people and a baby, and you didn't. I don't like it as much as the first film, but I can eke it over to a weak recommend. I didn't have a bad time watching this movie.
I actually salute that, because again, if I liked the movie last week, this is better, in my estimation, in every single way, except the novelty of it. I admit, if by doing so much of what you already did, maybe this trick is running out of gas. Maybe they will have to do something other than found footage for the later movies. I don't really know. I don't think any of us know. But I do believe the next one is the one, I mean, all trilogies, right? You go back to the beginning. I think the next one is the prequel, where we're going to find out the childhood story.
Damn it, I want to know what happened to Hunter.
Yeah, I figure it's going to be Hunter.
I mean, this is part of the reason I recommended it. I left in suspense at the end. If you stayed till the end credits, you got to hear Hunter giggle. Hunter likes whatever the demon is doing to it. I want to know, what is the demon indoctrinating this baby for? I don't want to go back. I want to go forward.
I mean, couldn't it be both? It could be Godfather 2. We could get the future and the past.
You cannot say Godfather 2 and Paranormal Activity in the same breath. No, I'm not allowing it.
That was fun. Yeah, I did. I don't think it's going to be Godfather 2, but we'll find out what it is next week.
And meanwhile, thank you, patrons, for joining us, and donors. While some of us didn't enjoy the loud noises made by this movie, hopefully you've enjoyed the loud noises made by the three of us for the past hour and a half. And so now, let's get back to the present.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this bonus movie review.
You know, I've heard of spirit photography before, but I've never actually seen it in person.
It's your support that keeps Now Playing operating.
We're so grateful that you're here. Thank you so much.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Venganza Media Incorporated.
This isn't, you know, Casper, the fucking friendly ghost you're chasing, man.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders.
I think that probably was illegal in Kentucky and other 12 states.
They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended. Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the express written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
A final ritual, and that's where he's going to be.
Is she sure? Then we should call the cops.
Call the cops and tell them what?
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2021, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Fuck this shit, I'm done.
And she's doing, you know, lighting incest. She's lighting incense.
Redheaded stepchild of the Saw family.
I guess they're all forgotten children to me.
Until the latter ones, until the post-Carrie Elwes one.
I forgot there was one this year. Chris Rock, all right.
I know. So do I, and I reviewed it.